just about. I've misjudged the freeway. That's a great way to test your serenity. It's my sponsor's fault. Okay. Anyway, I'm here. Congratulations to everyone, the birthday people and newcomers, 30-day chips. Lila, it's great to see you. And Dory and all of you. My name is Tony. I'm an alcoholic. Did I say that? No, I didn't. Okay. I want to say, I've just been talking to a newcomer. She's 7 days sober. And I met her father on my first night in AA. Lila and George picked me up and took me to my first meeting. December 29th, 1975, to the Pacific Palisades Group. And I met this guy called Mike. And he was new. I think he slept and come back in, and I remember him saying when I was introducing him, he said, "I'm just sick and tired of being sick and tired." And I say to all newcomers, don't go back out there if you can possibly avoid it. There's nothing out there. This is the place to be. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous in 1975, and it changed my life, just like that. And I haven't had a drink since, so thank you very much. What is it like? What happened? And what is it like now? Well, I was born in Wales. That's a good excuse to get drunk. We were the Irish who couldn't swim. I don't think any of you know where Wales is. You think it's in Ireland. Americans say that. They say, "Where's Wales? Is it in Scotland?" I said, "No, forget it." We were the Irish who couldn't swim. We were the Celts. This is the Celtic disease. It's the Russian disease, it's the world disease, alcoholism and addiction. What happened? I was born 1937, and I always do everything at the end of the year, December 31st, 1937. And I got sober on the 29th of December, 1975. My last drink was on December 27th. What happened was from a very early age, when I went to school, I knew I was on the wrong planet. I was the only child. My parents were loving, obsessive. My father used to say of me to my mother, "There's something radically wrong with this boy," which is not the foundation for self-esteem as you grow up. I had a sort of idyllic childhood. I was born in a beautiful part of South Wales. It rained a lot, but it was very beautiful. And I remember my first few years very, very clearly. I got one of those weird memories. I can remember back to the age of 2 and things like that, and I remember odd little things. And I went to school, and that's when I knew I was on the wrong planet. I was convinced that, I didn't have this kind of thought in my head at the time, but I felt, looking back, that everyone else had the big book of life, and somehow I missed out on it because I didn't know what the rules of the game were. And I felt like that all my life. And as a school child, I was probably maybe dyslexic or whatever they call it, ADD or whatever the hell it's all called. I think I was just an idiot, I couldn't think of all fancy names for it, I was just stupid. I used to sit at the back of the class. My mother used to sit up with me at night, 2 and 2 make 4. I was 16 then. 2 and 2 make 4. And I remember this road to Damascus experience, which is 2 and 2, 4. Ah. And I got it. I was about 2 years behind everyone else. All the other kids had got that. So there was something not quite right up here. I probably had a ADD or whatever. And so that really put me in the doghouse. And I couldn't play sport. I was not athletic. I was, believe it or not, a puny kid. And I was very listless and slow. And I guess, as everyone thought, I was dumb. But I was just different, I guess. And all the other kids would be down the other end of the street playing, and I'd be up the other end of the street looking at my fingernails. That's all I used to do, stand in the corner of the street, like, the alcoholic with a hole in his gut and the wind blowing through. And that was my feeling as a child and growing up. And what I did have, I guess, was a kind of artistic streak. I was good at drawing and painting and music and all that. So I guess I was an artist, or I was an artistic, which wasn't very, very good to be that in those days. Where I came from, you had to be playing rugby, which is our national football or rugby game. I couldn't even do that. I actually played rugby once, and I caught the ball once, and I saw these fellas rushing towards me. So I thought maybe there were other problems with me. You know, I was in Wales, rugby is the man's sport. If you don't play rugby, there's something wrong with you. Well, I wondered what the hell was wrong with me. I couldn't do anything, you know. They used to call me a dreamer. My headmaster at the school used to call him, said that I was educationally subnormal. That was on my report. He is educationally subnormal, which, of course, is not another way to encourage self-esteem. And so I grew up into adolescence, and it became more and more painful. I couldn't talk to girls, and I guess we've all been through that. I was very shy and very withdrawn from everyone, and that's the only tactic I knew, was to withdraw. If you didn't like me, or if you give me a bad time, I wouldn't speak to you, and I'd cut you off, and that would be the end of that. And I grew with that kind of resentment all my life. And my father, God rest his soul, I think my father was an alcoholic. He's one of those periodics, you know, he drank, and when he did drink, he went through the personality disorder. And I remember coming home from school, and the teacher introduced us to the Lord's Prayer and the 23rd Psalm and Jesus and all the rest of it, and I didn't know what they were talking about. I was kind of awestruck, though, over the concept of heaven and God, and I'd never heard these words before, but I remember they stayed very much with me, deep in my subconscious, or deep in my consciousness, really, very much like Bill Wilson, that, you know, when he was in England during the First World War, those things that stayed with him, those strange impressions of spirituality, and those were with me at a very early age. I got home and my father said it was a load of rubbish, you know, it was nothing. It's a dog-eat-dog world. Get them before they can get you. And that was his philosophy. That's what he tried to live, but he didn't. He was a big softy like all the rest of us. But he tried to live like that. He felt like Willie Loman, you know, he always missed the boat somehow. And that's how I grew up. No blame, no pointing fingers, and nobody was guilty. But for some strange reason, I was cursed with the brand Mark X alcoholic. And I didn't know it. I think I was born an alcoholic. I probably picked it up from my father's side of the family. My grandfather, his father, was 25 years dry, white-knuckled, and he was a madman. He signed the pledge, and he's crazy. Vegetarian and non-drinker, non-smoker, nuts, you know. He didn't have... And so I went through my adolescence, and again, my poor father, God love you, he used to say there's something wrong with us. Well, I don't know what's going to happen to him, he used to say to my mother. I don't know what's going to happen to him, he's hopeless, you know. But he didn't mean any harm by that. He wanted me to do the best I could, you know. He was a baker, and he wanted me to come into the business. I would have ruined it for him. And just by a series of coincidences and flukes and perhaps miracles, I stumbled into the acting business and as a young kid, as a student. And I trained for a little while, and I went in my military service. And booze hadn't affected me in those days. I mean, I used to drink, but not much. And I started doing my military service, or what you used to call the draft over here. We called it national service over there. And I spent 2 years... In uniform, and sometimes on Saturday nights I'd go into the local town in Wiltshire, down to Salisbury, and I'd have a couple of drinks, but no problems, and just drank normally, and that was the way it was. I can't even remember getting drunk, but I had the terrible feeling that I didn't fit in. I just didn't fit in anywhere. I couldn't do anything in the army. I was hopeless. I worked in the clerk's office. I couldn't even do that job. I didn't know how I survived. It was like a cat with nine lives. That's been the story of my life, a cat with nine lives, always falling on my feet, you know. I'm getting away with murder. And I guess that's the charm of the... We live charmed lives. Fools and drunks. And that was my life. I came out of the army and I tried the acting career. And then in the early 60s, then it started. And I was on the treadmill of alcoholism. I began... I didn't recognize it at the time, but whenever I drank, I got drunk. And whenever I drank and got drunk, I got sick and ill and violent. And I was nobody's friend. And I would pick a fight with anyone if you got in my way. And I was moody and obstreperous. The thing was that I worked harder than anyone could imagine. I mean, I used to be in rehearsals 3 hours ahead of everyone else. And that literally was. People would start rehearsing in those days, you know, 10 o'clock in the morning. I'd be there 7. Well, the cleaners were cleaning up the building, and I'd be rehearsing on my own. And I prided myself. God, I thought I worked hard. I worked hard. And worked. I did it in order to be 15 moves ahead of everyone else. And if they picked on me, we'll be tied. I go for the jugular. and I particularly hated directors. Anything in authority figure, I would attack them if they pushed the wrong buttons. So I had a checkered career through those years, and I joined some pretty big companies, and I had some worked with some pretty top-class people, and they were very good people, and I worked at the National Theatre. That's when my drinking got really started to get out of hand. I wasn't dangerously so. I mean, everyone was drunk in England in those days, and my I had some pals, some of them are dead now, they drank and they were alcoholics, and some of them are unemployable, or their lives are broken and wrecked. And I was working with a big cheese there, the guy who directed the place, his name was Laurence Olivier, and he warned me, he said, I don't want to name drop, but that's the fact, I was working under his direction. And he said to me once, he said, you drink too much. I said, it's none of your business. He said, well, it is my business, I'm running this company. He said, you drink during rehearsals and you're drunk when you go on stage. And so I walked out before they could fire me. You know, that's the best thing I could do. I was clever. I thought I would walk out before they could get me. You know, get out while the heat was on. And I've gone through one marriage, which was a disaster. No fault of anyone's. Her marriage didn't work out. Produced a daughter, a young girl, and I left after 2 years of this nightmare and met my second wife, who was not an alcoholic. Neither was my first wife, but my second wife was not an alcoholic. I don't think she is anyway. And she stayed with me through those years of drunkenness, and she said I wasn't that bad, but I wouldn't have given me more than 5 minutes if I'd been looking at me. But we trundled along, and then my career started moving along, and I was given an opportunity to come to America to do a film here, and I did, and I discovered tequila. And I came out to California. Oh, God, I love tequila. This tequila got me into this outfit. It unzipped my brain and gave me trips, gave me quasi-religious experiences, which are very odd, because I was an atheist. And I went back to England, and I was following up. I was going to come to New York to do a play, and I couldn't wait to get back here just to drink tequila. I didn't know that they sold it in London. I don't think they sold it that much, but tequila, I couldn't wait to get there, because this is my first taste of psychedelic experience. And it was, I guess, hallucinogenic, I'm told. I don't know much about it, but what it did to me was made me very funny and very strange. And I came to New York, and I was in this play, and 8 months of a successful play, and I was then in the grips of chronic galloping alcoholism. I was a full-blown alcoholic, and my life was completely out of control. I finished the play at night. I was a quick change artist. As soon as the play was over, I'd be out before the audience could get over to the bar. And people would come into the bar and they'd go, not just you on stage. Cunning, baffling, and powerful, that's what we are. And I drank anything I couldn't chew. And my wife, my long-suffering wife, would be at home and with the dinner in the oven. And I didn't think anything of it, except I was racked with remorse. And I used to sit in those bars in New York, and I knew a lot of fancy knowledge. I knew things like distances and light years of our nearest galaxies. And I knew all that. And yet I get lost in the men's room. And I thought I was an intellectual giant. I was there with all the other brain surgeons and rocket scientists, you know. And I thought this was life, and the whole parade was going on outside, and I didn't even know it. And I met a woman then, that production I was in. Her name was Mary. She died recently. She died a few years ago. She died sober. But I was very attracted to Mary. She was always smiled, and she was always laughing at my dumb, silly jokes. She was Irish-American. She had a great sense of humor. And a very husky voice. She smoked a lot. And somebody said to me once, they said, you know Mary's an alcoholic? I said, really? Yeah. They said, yeah, she's an alcoholic. I said, oh, that's terrible. She doesn't seem to drink. I said, no, well, she's a member of AA. It was the Automobile Association. It said, AA. They said, yeah, Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, oh, God, that's terrible. She doesn't drink at all. They said, no, not even a beer. No wonder she smokes a lot. But she did. Sometimes she'd come with me, and we'd have a little something to eat and over the bar in Charlie's in 46th Street, whatever it was, 45th Street. And sometimes I'd say, you know, would you like a beer? She'd say, nope. She'd give me that AA smile. No. Can't you drink beer? No, don't worry about me, I'm okay. She never bothered me, she never told me, she never pointed the finger at me. But she used to report to her ex-husband that was also in the program. She'd say, you know, Tony was drunk tonight. He was smashed out of his mind. She'd go, let him die. She'd go, I should say something. He said, don't say anything. You know the program. Don't leave him alone. He'll get it if he's meant to get it. And sure enough, she obeyed all those rules, you know, the traditions, and she didn't promote Alcoholics Anonymous to me. She didn't try to advise me. She just let me fall around. And one night I asked her for some help, and we went out for a meal the next day, and I was in very bad shape. And she explained the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and she explained what alcoholism was. She said, it's I remember her quote. She said, it's cunning, baffling, and powerful. And she said, it's progressive, and it's terminal, and there's no cure for it. And I thought, what the hell is she talking about? There's no cure. How is she sober? She said, but if you don't take that first drink, you won't get drunk. Now, that's a big insult to a brilliant intellectual giant like myself. If you don't drink, you won't get drunk. Well, a child knows that, but I didn't know it. And I think she said something, it's not the engine that kills you, it's not the sixth truck that kills you, it's the engine, the one in front, it's the first drink that kills you. And she said, it's like coming on the, getting on the, well, you got it on the elevator from the top floor of the penthouse suite and going all the way down to the basement. She said, you can get off at any time you want. I still didn't get it. She said, would you like to come to a meeting? I said, no. And, but I did manage to stay dry for 6 weeks and white-knuckled it, and I felt quite comfortable. I think it was my higher power's way of showing me that there were ways of doing this. But when I next took my next drink, it was July 1975, and that was the worst. It was helter-skelter. I came out here to California in July 75, and I remember being at somebody's house up in Palisades. My whole life seems to revolve around Palisades, because that's where I live now. But it is odd. I just have made these connections recently. I went to this, he was a motion picture actor guy, and he had a big party, 4th of July, and it was on the lawn of his house. And I was drinking Diet Coke or something. And I remember thinking, well, obviously I don't have a problem. You know, I've been dry. What's the point? I'm not an alcoholic. So I was about to pour a scotch or something into my Diet Coke, and a well-meaning friend said, and I nearly took her head off. Because little did she know how close she was to being killed. Because she was stopping me drinking. But anyway, I didn't drink. And inevitably, I did take that first drink. I was working up at Trank or something, wasn't I? Started drinking, and I started drinking tequila. And that was 6 months of the worst nightmare I've ever known. And I hallucinated. I had real serious hallucinations. I mean, weird hallucinations. As I said, they were quasi-religious hallucinations, which is odd because I was an atheist. I saw Jesus walking with the Virgin Mary on Malibu. And I did. I saw that, and I said to this friend, I said, look, there's Jesus. They say, oh, yeah. And they'd walk away from me, you know. And I did all kinds of weird things like that. But I'm very fortunate because, and then I would drive my car blacked out, and I'd drive up over the canyons and over the valley, and I'd check the radiator of the car in the morning, see if there was a dent in it, if there was any blood, if I killed anyone. I didn't know, because I couldn't remember how I'd been anywhere, and my wife was very worried, and she did the typical non-alcoholic thing. She just sulked but didn't cross me at all. Sometimes I'd hear her crying in the bathroom, and that was the most humiliating experience of all. And then finally, Christmas 1975, she decided to go back to London to see her family, her folks, and leave me to die if that's what I chose to do. And she knew that she couldn't help me anymore. She was tired and beaten by all this. I was never violent, but I was just a pain to be with, depressed and miserable. I used to dread 5 o'clock at night coming. I used to try and hold on through the day. And she, I remember dropping her at the airport, and on my way down this area, I remember saying to her, I said, I think I'm an alcoholic, and I think I may need help. She said, well, it's up to you, isn't it? She said, I can't help you anymore. I said, yeah, screw you too, I thought. And I dropped her at the airport, and I said, have a good Christmas. She said, yep. She walked away. And the coldness I felt from her at that moment, I thought, I've lost everything I've ever wanted. Everything that's been the stability in my life is gone. And I knew I was on the point of losing everything. But I took off, and I went down to Palm Springs. I was on my way to Arizona. In fact, I was on my way to Santa Fe. I wanted to get down to New Mexico to get hold of peyote that they talk about in Carlos Castaneda's book, which I've never read, but I've heard about. I never had the attention span to read anything. I must read it Monday. But I got as far as Phoenix. And I stopped off in Palm Springs with some people. And I got as far as Phoenix. And I was in such bad shape, I felt that loneliness that only the alcoholic suffers. I don't think we cornered the market on loneliness, but it was a special loneliness that I felt, which was death. I felt in a godless universe, although I didn't believe in God, and I felt bereft of everything. And I stayed in this Fleabag hotel, this filthy hotel downtown Phoenix, and I had some crazy notion. I started writing poems and all that, and burying them under the top of the wardrobe, and I made my way back, and eventually I got back to Los Angeles on the 27th of December, and I went down to the Beverly Glen Market to get my bottle of tequila, and I thought, well, I may as well end it now, because there's nothing left else. That maybe with a bit of luck, I'll have a heart attack. I don't want to kill anyone, so I'll drive very carefully. But maybe I'll have a heart attack, or maybe I'll have the guts to jump out the window, I don't know. And I sat in that apartment in Westwood, and I, on Wilshire Boulevard, and I remember looking across the courtyard of this place, and the evening shadows were getting longer, that magic time, and I felt the loneliness of the world on me, and I felt useless, and I felt like garbage, and that's exactly what I'd become, was garbage in a way, spiritual garbage, I guess. The phone rang and I was invited to a party, and I don't remember much about the party except I was sitting under the piano most of the evening, which is not a place for a social group to be, getting into a fight with some other actor, and my agent was there, and he said, come on Tony, it's time you went home. He took me out the doorstep, and I stood there, and I said, I've lost my car. He said, no, you didn't lose it. He said, I said, well, somebody stole it. He said, no, nobody stole it. He said, you left it in the middle of the street, you know, with the lights on and the radio going, and traffic all around you, and you were standing there like a maniac. I said, was I? He said, don't you remember? I said, no. I said, I know one thing, though, I'm an alcoholic and I need help. And the light went on in my head. I remember standing under the eucalyptus trees up in Holmby Hills, looking up at the sky, or wherever it was. Holmby Hills. This guy in a nice house, looking up at the eucalyptus trees. And I remember there's a Paul Newman film called Somebody Up There Likes Me. And I thought, somebody up there really likes me, because I should be dead by now, what I've done. And I said, I need help, and I need it fast. And on the Monday morning, I took Sunday to think about it. So I'm lucky I'm here, because I thought about the 24 hours for an alcoholic to think, and is enough to, send you really over the edge. But I didn't drink. And on the 29th, I phoned up Central Office in West Los Angeles, in the Westwood office. And this woman, an elderly sounding voice, said, hi, Alcoholics Anonymous, may I help you? I said, my name is, I think I'm an alcoholic. She said, good. I said, I feel terrible. She said, that's wonderful. I said, I think I'm finished. She said, that's wonderful, honey. Shall we send somebody over to see you? I said, no. I knew somebody was going to come over and visit me with a Bible and a bottle of booze and charity, and some Christian women handed me cookies. Hi, honey. Jesus loves you. That's what I thought was going to happen. And I hated all that stuff. But I didn't care. At that point, I thought, I'll do anything. I'll wear white robes. I'll stand in the middle of Sunset Boulevard in white robes. I said, I'll do whatever they tell me to do. I wanted the heat off. I wanted the monkey off my back. And I didn't care if I died. I really didn't care if I died. I lost everything anyway. I lost all decency. And I felt that any decency I'd had was finally draining away from me. Now, I think we do over-dramatize things. And I know I've got a tendency to do that. But I went in and I said, no, I'll come and see you. So I went into Westwood Boulevard, which is the Western office. And I went up the stairs, and it was in the old location, and there was Dorothy, and she's an elderly lady, and I sat down, and it wasn't what I expected. I thought there'd be drunks lying around the wall holding each other's hands, saying, Thursday you can go out and drink, we'll make sure you don't do too much, and then you come out with us and make sure we don't drink. That's what I thought it was. I said, I didn't know. I thought we took it in turns to drink another. But instead it was a nice sort of, wooden panel office, and the smell of coffee, and the sunlight was coming through, and there's a white-haired lady called Dorothy. And I sat down, and she did all the talking, and she said her husband was a sound engineer in the motion picture business, and she said Alcoholics Anonymous had saved his life, and she herself was not an alcoholic, she was just doing the phones because she wanted to give something back. And she said, alcoholism kills, honey. And she said, you look terrible. I said, thank you very much. She said, but that's the best place to be. She said, because there's still a light on in you somewhere. And she said, you don't ever have to take a drink again. She said, give me your address and your phone number. And as I got up to go, she did something which was really amazing, and it changed my life. And it was about 11 o'clock in the morning, December 29th, sunny morning, January. And she said, as I was going, she said, remember, why don't you just come home and rest? She said, why don't you just come home and rest? And then I knew she was going to spring the dreaded three-letter word at me. And she said, why don't you just trust in God? And at that moment, the floodgates opened, and I thought, well, everything I've done has failed. Any attempts I've had at self-knowledge and reading philosophy and psychology and all that stuff that I tried to read, which never really got through, they didn't understand anyway. I'd read Norman Vincent Peale's book on positive thinking, and all very good books, but for the alcoholic, it's not enough. And she said, why don't you just trust in God? And I just grabbed hold of her and held her. I got very emotional. I'd never held anyone before. I didn't trust anyone. I didn't want anyone to hold me. I'm strong, and I nearly crushed this poor little lady, you know. I got down on the street, and the most amazing thing happened. In Westwood Boulevard that morning, 11 o'clock in the morning, it was like everything got lighter, and in my head or around my shoulders, there was a sense like stereophonic sound, which is a wraparound sound that said, it's all over, and now you can start again. And don't forget one moment of it, because it's all been for a purpose. Now go about your business. And I knew without a doubt that that's what it was. It was the ground of all being, or God. And I've tried to analyze it, and I've given up. But I think what has happened, the image I have at that moment was that because I'd made the attempt, I saw an image in my own mind, my hand picking up a phone and saying, help me. And at that moment, I guess my ego was broken, and all my defenses collapsed. Now, I'd never been in hospital, I'd never been in jail, I'd never been arrested, I'd never been fired from a job. I was walked up before they could get me. So I was, I guess, what you would technically call a high-bottom drunk. You know, I had money in the bank, I had a car, my wife, not in that order, I had money in the bank and a car, and a nice car, a career which was going well. So I was what they call a high-bottom drunk, I suppose. And but what happened was it happened. And from that second, the craving to drink left me. And that was 23 years ago, it's never come back. I don't understand it. I mean, you know, I'm around booze a lot. We all are. They didn't close the bars when I stopped drinking. But somehow, it doesn't register with me anymore. I've been out to restaurants, and sometimes if I'm a bit tired and there's a bit of a glass of wine in front of me, I've just pushed away because the smell makes me feel nauseous. But that's weird. So a miracle took place in my life. As Lila says tonight, the miracles take place in our lives here. To the newcomers, if you've got any doubts about being an alcoholic, don't waste time trying to experiment. But I can't tell you that because that's up to you to decide. But I realized that that night, and so I was picked up that Monday evening by Lila and George, and they were just what I expected them to be. I thought George was crazy. He nearly broke my hand when he shook and said, hi, my name's George, I'm an alcoholic. And Lila and George, we traveled all the way from Westwood to Pacific Palisades. They didn't shut up 1 minute. Lila was leaning over the back and said, you know, it's all about ego, and it's this and it's that. These people are nuts. We got to the meeting, and there was a big car park, and there was an actor going down, an elderly fellow going down, and I'd worked with him a few months before, and I said, what's he doing? He said, he's an alcoholic. I said, God, I worked with him in November. He said, will you meet him in a moment? I went in, and he said, hello, Tony, how are you? He said, I've got a seat waiting for you. I said, you have? Yes. He said, good to see you. I knew you'd make it. I said, did you know? He said, oh, come on, my friend. Of course I knew you're an alcoholic. He said, the moment I shook hands with you, your hands were wet, you know. This was the previous November. And I sat between these two men, George and Lila Simons and Bob, and both were my sponsors eventually. And the two speakers that night, one was called Don, and he was a doctor from Palos Verdes, and the other was a man called Chuck C., and he was the second speaker. And it was Don who made me realize that there was something really identifiable in my nature that was killing me. And he said his moment of crisis, his moment of revelation, was when he was standing over a patient. He was a surgeon, and the patient was open, and he wasn't sure whether to sew her up or operate. And the sister in the theater said, sew her up, Doc, you've already operated. He said that's when he realized he was an alcoholic, because he'd operated in the blackout. And everyone laughed in the room, and I thought, they're all mad. And then Chuck got out, he said, my name's Chuck, I'm an alcoholic. He said, by the grace of God, I have 30 years sober this January. And he had that weird laugh, you know. And I thought, he must be brain dead. I mean, how can anyone be 30 years sober? And he talked, he said something, he said, if anyone out there has got a resentment against me, he said, that's your problem, not mine. And he said, that's your problem. And he said, because I'm going to go home and sleep well tonight, but if you've got the problem, that's your problem. And he he talked about surrender, and he said surrender, and he said the moment he gave up trying to make a fortune, he made 10 million or something. The moment he gave up trying to travel around the world, he traveled around many times. The moment he stopped trying to make his family into a family, they became a family. And for some reason, I guess I was so open and so beaten that I understood exactly what he was talking about. And he mentioned that night that alcoholism is a symptom of a personality disorder. Now, that sounded pretty good for me. And I looked around the room, I thought everyone in this room has felt like me. And I remember that Monday night that I'd come home. I really had come home. Because I'd been looking for this all my life. And those feelings of loneliness and being on the outside more or less went away. They still come back sometimes, but more or less they went away. I'd always been a loner, and I still am a bit, but that's okay, I can live with that, I like it. And I was taken out, I went to see Chuck afterwards, after the meeting, and George introduced me, this is Tony, Tony's first meeting, and Chuck put his hands on my shoulders, he said, you just keep coming back, Sonny, he said, because we get better than better. He said, we're recovering from a seemingly hopeless disease. He said, God love you, he said. And I walked away and went home. And next day, George and Bob took me out for lunch, and they explained to me the nature of alcoholism and what it does and how it kills you. And I just continued going to meetings, day at a time, one day at a time. And my first meeting, I met Mike, and we were sponsored by George. And his daughter's here tonight in 7 days. And I can only say this is the best deal in town. I'm in the acting profession, and I've been very successful over the years, and I worked hard, and I was on the point of giving it up when I got sober, and somebody said, you're just warming up, you know, you ain't seen nothing yet, so I didn't know what they were talking about, but I continued with my profession, and that's my job. I used to be ashamed of saying I was an actor, but that's my job, it's like anything else, it just happens to be an actor. And I got caught up in all that stuff, the importance of it all and all that, which is fine. But recently, I think what AA does, it gradually strips you away, and it's like shedding skins. And I came to a point recently when I suddenly lost the whatever it is about my profession, and I suddenly don't want to be addicted to success or addicted to the excitement or the addicted to the drama of it. It's just tiresome, and it's tiring, and I'm getting too old for all that. So maybe I'll go back to one day and do something small or something light or something easy, you know. But what has happened is because I remember Lila saying once, she said about alcoholics, she said, you know, we change or die, grow or go. It's this life or death thing, and we have to change, we have to keep moving. And I think, and I think that's what happens. I thought I knew everything when I came, and I don't know much now. All I know is that what's important to me now, I've been through a thing, which I'm not going to go into these things, these are personal things. I've been through some kind of a change recently, which is a personal change, and as a result of being an alcoholic, I've done some crazy things, and I've done some things which may be courageous, I don't know. But I've made some changes in my life. They're big changes, dramatic changes, I think. I may be making the biggest mistake of my life, I don't know. But I've come out here to live in California, finally, which is my spiritual home, really, which is odd, because I was born in Wales. And I feel, as I came in tonight, and I was middle-aged, you know, and I sat there with Jim and Josh at the back of the hall, and it reminded me of the old days when I used to come to meetings like this, you know. I haven't been to this one before, but I remember standing back. There was a whole semblance of people, like the guy who's just mentioning this thing now, just a wonderful sort of collaboration of people in these meetings. And what it's done to me, I think my attention has been caught by some higher power, which is saying, you know, it's time to let go of what you've been so used to, and now it's time to do some work. Now it's time to get back into the line, get into the back into the program, and be of service. And it's the best education I've ever had. I remember somebody guy, I mean, what I'm saying now is just a repetition of what I've heard over the years. I remember a guy called Mel, who's now dead, but Mel said this is $1 million education, a nickel at a time. And I've learned more about humanity and life, and you know, I can't say I've learned about humility, because if I say that, then I've lost it. But we do learn about humility here. And without this program, without this room, without you, I'd be nothing. Everything I got on this, you know, I should be dead. I would have died years ago. I would have been unemployable and dead. But I'm compelled to do things now that I've never done before. I've got involved, I've only just been back in Los Angeles about 3 weeks. I've got involved with a woman's recovery place down in the marina here. and run by a remarkable woman, Sustaid, and extraordinary. And I go to this house once a week. Oh, I've been tired, so I haven't been able to get that regularly. And they come up to my house, a group of them, the women, and we have a meeting there. And it's a great privilege, you know, suddenly to see another world, a woman's world, and with the pain that women are in alcoholism and the fear they have of men and the abuse they've received, and some of them coming off the streets. And it really is a million-dollar education. And I'm glad to be back. And I got that feeling that I was sitting there with the next gym. I thought, it's like being back in the old days of beginning to get active again. And this leaves whatever I've done as, you know, my profession. You know, I'm not discounting the profession I'm in. It's a great life, and I have a great time. It's paid me well. That's important, and it's good. And I've had some fun with it. I've met some interesting people. But this is the place that really counts. I spent all my life looking for the beautiful people, and I found them here, you know. And it sounds sentimental, but it's true. And I don't want to ever go back out there. And I think, I hope for the newcomer, you're not forced to do that either. Nobody forces us to go back out there. And I'll just wrap up by saying, I remember once I was coming on a plane, the weird nature of alcoholism. I don't know why I'm an alcoholic. I'm coming on a plane from New York to Los Angeles. I was sober about a year. And it must have been a holiday or something. Anyway, I was coming back on this plane and I'd been... And this flight attendant came up with a bottle of champagne. She said, "Free champagne, everyone." And I'd been about a year or so, and she said, "Champagne." She poured it in the man next to me, who I noticed had a glass of whiskey. They're all the whole flight. He didn't even drink it. So he wasn't an alcoholic. She leaned up. She said, "Champagne." I said, "No, not for me, thanks." She said, "Come on, just a little champagne, celebrate." I said, no. She said, "Why not?" I said, "I've got a report for work next Monday." I said, "Well, I don't understand." I said, "No. Nor do I. I just have an orange juice." You know, I say to my wife sometimes, "Why do you bother to drink?" You know, she does all that. Nice nutty flavor. I said, "What do you get out of it?" She said, "Well, it takes the edge off." I said, "What edge?" She smokes a cigarette and doesn't inhale it. What is the point? What's the point of doing it? And I will wrap up now, but there's just one thing. I remember my first... It was February. I remember February, and it was, I think it was the 28th. It was in... I read in the Los Angeles Sunday Times, 1976, and I was newly sober, and it said, "The Rand Corporation had discovered a new pill, or created a new drug, which could help us to drink like normal drinkers." But being new, I thought, "God, this is... Maybe AA's got it all wrong. A drug that can make us drink like normal drinkers." So I went to the Ohio Street meeting, and one of these old timers got up and said, "Hey, guys, read the LA Times today." And somebody said, "Yeah. Anyone in this room wants to drink like a normal drinker?" "No." Thank you very much.